But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belfry.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investor portfolios. My name is Jack McRae and I'm joined today by Brooks McDonald CIO Will Hobbs. Will completed his move to the UK wealth management firm last month, having most recently been serving as head of multi-asset wealth at Barclays. He spent more than two decades at the bank in a number of roles, including CIO for the bank's wealth and investments division. Welcome, Will.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. And you're a month in to the job at Brooks McDonald's. How's the switch been?
I mean, it's less than, do you know what? So it's just 3 weeks. And do you know what? It's always, as a sort of investment wonk, it's always so exciting, and this sounds weird, but to see how another place, another shop has, you know, skinned the cat as such. And there's many ways, as you know, of doing multi-asset class funds and portfolios, and many ways of doing it right. Mm-hmm. And so it's been so interesting finding out, looking under the bonnet, reading all the process documents and meeting all the individuals. And it's been great. The performance is good. The proposition is in a good state. So it's not one of those where you have to come in and say, okay, let's start again. Far from it. Do you know what? I feel quite privileged.
Yeah. And I guess the obvious question I have to ask is, after such a long time at the bank, why did you decide to leave?
Well, so it's a complicated question. So I had over two decades, like you say. I'd had a long-term problem with my leg that was becoming increasingly annoying. And in September last year, I had to have it chopped off. And so I wanted to recover from that operation without having to think about work for a little bit. So I asked Barclays whether they would sort of let me go and, you know, let me do the operation. So I sort of got redundancy from Barclays without having a job to go to. The operation all went well. And then suddenly, sort of 2 months, I'd been sort of looking at a lot of different places and different opportunities. And actually, you know, I'd really thought that using this opportunity to take a completely fresh look at my career, and I looked at development banks, wealth managers, asset managers, and all those kind of things. But actually, when the opportunity at Brooks came up, it was almost exactly what I was looking for and the type of people that I wanted to work for mm-hmm. and with. So it was just kind of a little bit of serendipity, I guess. Yeah. Everything came together at the right moment, and yes. So it's been, like I say, I'm sort of thanking my lucky stars a little bit.
And Brooks previously had a co-CIO mm-hmm. set up. Are you up to the challenge of filling two pairs of shoes, essentially?
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, probably not. You know, that's the thing. They've done a great job, you know, Rich and Mike. And so Mike is obviously sticking around, and Rich is sort of, you know, mm-hmm. heading off to pastures fresh. And in a way, part of what they're asking me to do, because Rich and Mike have done such a good job of doing what a lot of wealth managers have been doing, which is kind of centralizing a lot of the investment function, bringing sort of outcomes together as much as is possible. The work now is about sort of, in a way, sort of taking it on to the next stage, which is sort of building out the sort of, you know, strategic asset allocation and some of the asset allocation facilities, you know, introducing little bits and bobs, little bells and whistles where I can. And that's something I'd really enjoy. So it's something that, you know, I did with a team back in Barclays for many years, and particularly after kind of 2018 as CIO in wealth, and in a way, designing robust customer outcomes, it was a sort of very, you know, satisfying intellectual kind of work, but also when it came to the crunch, you know, putting it to test in some of the trickiest markets that we've had and it coming out on top during 2020 and ever since, that was very satisfying for the team and I to know that that work had, you know, had good client outcomes, satisfied customers at the end of it as such. And hopefully, you know, I can sort of help do that at Brooks to whatever extent is possible. So it's really, yeah, it's, but like I say, that, you know, it's a good question because I'm really joining an already very strong team.
Mm-hmm. I guess kind of leads on to my next question is the first impressions of Brooks. You mentioned, you know, how kind of well run it has been. That's kind of your first impression. Were you surprised? Kind of, did you know people there were kind of, did you know how well run it was before joining?
So, I've known a lot of people down the years who have worked there and still work there. And they had nothing but good stuff to say about the culture in particular. Mm-hmm. And really meeting the exco and the board, many of whom are new to the business, and hearing about their plans to take Brooks, you know, to the next level, that was a huge, you know, hugely appealing in many ways. Because one of the things you find, and I started off as a company analyst many centuries ago, it feels like.
Yep.
But, you know, part of the thing there is obviously that you're looking to evaluate management. And one of the tactics you use is sort of asking lots of different members of the exco the same question and seeing how joined up the kind of thing is. And it's impossible to get an exco completely coordinated. These are all individual people with, you know, ideas of their own and all those kind of things. But what really struck me about Brooks was that although everyone wasn't sort of saying exactly the same thing, they had a very similar idea about the opportunity to exploit and how to get there. Mm-hmm. And that kind of joined up feeling is kind of quite exciting to get hold of it. And the, you know, the CIO role in itself seems to have the sort of scope to be able to contribute to that, you know, that vision.
Yeah.
Of how the wealth market can progress and how we can contribute to it.
Yeah. You mentioned there's been comings and goings and you're obviously mm-hmm. the high profile Cummings. How do you gel with a, you know, a new senior leadership team?
Great question. You know, often it's about, and this is again, like a cultural thing, I think, that what I've found is a real openness. And because there's a mixture of people who've been there for a very long time and some new people and everything in between, you find that actually, and speaking to both newcomers and old uns, there's a very similarly kind of excited approach to sort of, you know, well, let's be open-minded and see where we can get to. And so that is kind of part of the thing. It's just building up trust. And you find, you know, in very big organizations like Barclays, you know, that can be the work of decades in a way. Mm-hmm. And you can find that quite often you have to go back to zero in order to, you know, because there's a higher turnover in a sense. But what you, I think, find with the Brooks team is that it's big enough to be serious, but it's small enough to be agile and inclusive on that front. And so what I've found is that just people have been incredibly welcoming.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a great attribute to have. And I think also in a way, like if you've got and this I think is true of the sort of some of the most successful businesses we know of in the history of our industry, that if you can get a load of motivated people turning up with a clear ambition in mind, not a million different ambitions, you can really get people kind of going as such. You can really achieve stuff. Whereas, you know, a lot of kind of more sort of businesses with lots of different arms, lots of different fingers and lots of different pies, it can be very difficult to get everyone to sort of think mm-hmm. about the same thing. And I think at Brooks, you know, the sense I've got is that there's many people who talk about being about the customer in the industry. Sometimes you say it so flippantly, you forget what you're actually meaning. My sense is that there is a real, real genuine interest in how to deliver good customer outcomes. And that's in part a function of how the business has developed in the past, its history.
Yeah. And you mentioned not wanting to kind of rip up the investment process. And, you know, you've only 3 weeks in, you've yes. just kind of seen the lay of the land. Mm. If we were to have this conversation again in a year, what will your team be doing differently?
Great question. Again, so, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that I would think about. So always in investments, and this is one of the things that really appeals to me about the space, is that it's kind of an arms race. At all times, you are being asked to evaluate the frontier of investment practice and see which of that is genuine progress and which of it is kind of smoke and mirrors and marketing speak as such. And so you're always looking to incorporate, you know, best practice here and there. And what I think, one of the things that the team and I were very successful at in my last place was really about some of the behavioral aspects. And this is something that Brooks already believes in as part of its investment philosophy. And so there's, I think, more work we can do on how decisions are made. That's one of the things about sort of, you know, how you organize meetings, how you get more out of the more junior members of the team, all of those kind of things. So in a way, like sort of some of it is about sort of just process and some of the sort of boring, mundane stuff. Some of it is about evaluating new asset classes for inclusion. Quite a lot of the sectors' portfolios are, and we've got sort of three broad buckets of, you know, exposures, but I think there's in a way room for some of the more, you know, idiosyncratic exposures, which gives us maybe more all-weather performance over time. The beauty is, though, but doing this from a position of performance strength, you know, I mean, in a way, it could be bad for me. If anything goes wrong, it's going to look terrible. But the innovations you can do and experiment with at the edges are really about just further increasing that quality rather than having to say, like, look, start again. The next 10 years' performance numbers are going to be rubbish. But, you know, because that's not the case. So, yes, tinkering.
Yeah.
Not uprooting.
Mm-hmm. And just focusing on assets now, I'm sure you saw yesterday, we're speaking on the 30th of April, Canaccord announced that they will offer crypto exposure for some of its richer clients. Is that, what's your first thoughts on that? And, you know, does Brooks have any plans to do similar?
Never rule anything out, do we? I mean, I still feel that as an investment opportunity, much of the crypto space is an answer looking for a question, to quote an old colleague. I mean, certainly sort of if you look at some of the sort of arguments underlying the Bitcoin standard and things like that, that feels economically illiterate to me still. Maybe I'm just too old and gray and balding to understand it. But, you know, these feel like momentum assets in a way. Mm-hmm. They can have role for investment portfolios, but it is so far not in the mainstream areas, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So actually your core asset allocation still revolves around, you know, the really liquid exposures. And I think, you know, if you're thinking about whether an asset deserves inclusion in your, you know, asset allocation, it's really got to have two things. You know, one, a positive expected return, a bonus. The second thing really is that if you add the assets together, is it going to add diversification appeal? So if I have two, three of these, four of these assets, how much do they co-move or how much do they offset each other and create a smoother path overall? And actually, if you look at markets overall, there's less than you might think in terms of actual diversifying assets or distinct shapes of returns. So far, you know, crypto is too young a space to say anything authoritatively, but it doesn't feel like one, you know, totally for us just for yet.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not in the mainstream bit anyway?
Yeah. And is that the same in private markets as well?
So private markets is a space that the business is definitely interested in. But I think that here, you know, the discussions internally are very much about gold plating, you know, due diligence. So, you know, this is something that there is. And again, I'm personally not sure that private assets are a different asset class. They are a way of organizing your exposure to two different asset classes. So, you know, you can say private equity is an overall space. The returns look very much like a long S&P 500 short cash position. But what you do get in these areas, I think, are quite, you know, particularly for the higher up ends of your kind of your distribution of, you know, wealth, they give you the ability to have quite discrete, segmented, you know, deliberate exposure as such rather than the diversified. So there's a narrative, a texture piece to these, to those investments, which I think is quite interesting. But rightly, the business is, you know, very much going at it the guilty until proven innocent route.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are part of the sort of, you know, the sort of the plans, but not necessarily wholesale offering at the moment.
And we're speaking just over an hour after the Bank of England made the decision to hold rates.
Yes.
I have to ask you your immediate thoughts.
Yeah, no, fine. I mean, so the central banking space is really interesting at the moment in a way. You know, the Kevin Warsh story in the US. And, you know, I note that he was in one of the Senate hearings saying that he thought central bankers talked too much or words to that effect. And to be honest, yeah, I sort of do agree. You know, in a way, like we need to remember a little bit, and this is true of all central banks, that there's no viewing platform of the future reserved specially for central bankers so they can get an extra glimpse at it. They're as blind to the vagaries of what comes next as the rest of us. So in a way, forward guidance did turn into a little bit, or has been turning into, this kind of hall of mirrors, because investors know they are being managed. Central bankers know they are managing investors who know they are being managed. It just becomes a little bit deleterious and time-wasting, in my opinion. And the industry spends an inordinate amount of time looking at these things. The reality is that central banks probably have less control over these levers than we might think. They're not, you know, they aren't sort of, don't have super agency. The UK specifically, I'll answer your question, rabbiting on in the sort of the wider context. I personally am actually, and this might mark me out as totally insane, but I'm a bit more bullish on the UK than most people. Mm-hmm. I tend to think actually that the data has been picking up for some time. That's not to say that we're not going to endure a price spike, but I'm not sure that automatically should translate us into, you know, a longer, more durable inflation shock, which is a little bit different. The UK consumer starts, and UK households start in aggregate, I'm not talking about the distribution here, but in aggregate, there's quite a lot of absorption capacity in balance sheets. Where that absorption capacity sits is a debate for the government, because obviously it's the poorest households that take the hit from energy prices the most. But in a way, this hit is survivable. And actually, there's a pickup, in my opinion, on what's going on in underlying activity in the UK. So I'm much less worried about the debt pile. I'm much less worried about the deficit, in a sense, over the medium term. And I do feel that there are more disinflationary forces beyond this price hike than many people are taking account of, you know, from China's, you know, overcapacity and involution and how that's exporting that to the rest of the world, to the incoming industrial revolution that will, you know, ultimately lower prices. The time frame of these things is a little bit unsure, and we've certainly got to get through this price spike first. But I would argue that probably we don't want to get carried away with what the central bank is going to do in the next year or two. Interest rates are at a quite different level to the 2022 shock already. And like I say, I think the UK is in a slightly better state than many. So everything's going to be fine, I hope.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I read through your outlook yesterday morning. And
thank you.
Notice the positivity on UK equities. What would derail this confidence?
Yeah, it's a good question again, Jack. So, I mean, a lot of that is to do with the fact it's not so much to do with the UK economy and a view on that, because as we know, UK equities and UK economy, they dance to different tunes in a sense. There is at the moment, there is certainly a sectoral appeal in terms of what the UK over-indexes in, certainly in the large cap space. And actually, I mean, if you get down into the mid-cap, there is a bit more of a macro tailwind. Part of it is just expectations-based, I guess. So really, if you look at what's going on in the US and you look at, you know, and even sort of the reaction to last night's incredible results, or a few incredible results, it's quite muted in general. And that mm-hmm. suggests that if you've got companies growing still this size by 30-odd percent, their operating profits, I mean, that is incredible. And to have sort of that already in the price is really quite something. And you've got the reverse story, really, in the UK. The valuation still suggests that not much is expected of the UK, even after 2 years of, you know, outperformance relative to the US. So the sector's already been picking up a bit. Our bet is that that can continue a little bit more. So, yes.
But you're less keen on emerging markets, and many would consider this to be quite the contrarian bet, particularly given the success of EM in 2025. Why are you betting against kind of the consensus here?
Yeah, that's a live discussion at the moment. It's a very good question. And I think, you know, one of the things that's kind of butting against the EM in the debate at the moment is that if you're looking at areas negatively impacted by what's going on in the Straits of Hormuz, Asia is really front and center. There are also aspects or concerns that you're playing into different parts of the same supply chain that you might be buying into with the US. So there's a kind of there's a sort of common factor there, but definitely that is one of the debates, like I say, live in the asset allocation team at the moment with regards to what extent can we get extra diversification, EM assets in general. So yeah, these things are, it's interesting in a way. I mean, sometimes I do think that the world is sliced up in quite odd ways when you think about developed and emerging markets. I mean, you know, when you go to Taiwan and Korea, you know, emerging market isn't the first thing that comes to mind. These are quite dated expressions in many ways, aren't they? These are highly developed, very sophisticated markets now. They've come on. They've developed, certainly as economies. So, and the same is true of China. So these things are, you know, moving fast. And I think really what one has to think about in that industrial revolution, you know, we always talk about sort of, you know, the picks and shovels phase is the first bit of the gold rush, isn't it? You know, you're always saying like, well, and in that case, that's semiconductors and, you know, you want to own that part of the supply chain because you don't really know where the technology is going to go. And we still don't quite know, but we're getting hints every week, every month, every quarter about where it might go. And you want to start focusing a little bit more on the adopters, the people buying it, the ultimate consumers of this technology, and how that gives them superpowers, be they consumers and so on. And so that starts to argue for a more imaginative investment strategy when it comes to equities and how you think about the next phase of the industrial revolution.
Well, that seems like a good point to end on. Thank you so much for joining us, Will. Pleasure. And we will see you next time on The Wealth Show.
Thank you, Jack.
Today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.